Portland. Stay tuned. Here comes the Old Mole Variety Hour.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to invite you to the KBOO Recollected Open House on Thursday, May 31st from 7 to 10 p.m. here at the station, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland.
Join us for a station open house and evening of on-air programming recollecting notable moments in KBOO Community Radio's early history.
Please join us to mingle with the program hosts, on-air guests, and KBOO community members.
Light snacks and drinks will be provided,
as well as the chance to view the evening's on-air programming while it happens.
Everyone is welcome. Again, that's KBOO Recollected Open House on Thursday, May 31st from 7 to 10 p.m.
at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland.
More information can be found at 50yearsofkboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is proud co-sponsor of the Vanport Mosaic Festival, a four-day multidisciplinary event from May 23rd to May 28th in various venues in North and Northeast Portland. The Vanport Mosaic Festival includes exhibits, art performances, a reunion and celebration of former Vanport residents, oral history documentary screenings of Priced Out and Lost City, Living Memories, and tours of the historic Vanport City. Again, that's the Vanport Mosaic Festival, a four-day multidisciplinary event from May 23rd to May 28th, taking place in various venues in North and Northeast Portland. More information about the festival, including specific performances, screenings, dates, times, and venues, can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Fred Magdoff, welcome.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBLO in Portland, where the time is 9:01, almost 9:02, and that's time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We call this show The Old Mole after Karl Marx's image of the revolution, that underground movement that works away at the withering roots of what superficially looks like healthy society, and then pops up where least expected to overthrow what is really a corrupt and oppressive system that makes a few people very rich and powerful, leaving the vast majority with little but crumbs and illusions. And we call this show a variety hour because so many different topics fall within our purview. Today, for example, we'll be hearing about how the soil where our food is produced is being rapidly degraded and poisoned. We'll learn how the Trump administration is trying to take women's choices about reproduction away from them. We'll hear about how the passion of patriotism encourages people to kill and die for ideals that, in fact, the nation has never really supported. And we'll look at the question of why most nations, including the U.S., do so little to stand up against Israel's constant outrages against the rights and lives of Palestinians. I'm Clayton Morgridge. I'm hosting today's show along with our engineer, Patsy Kullberg. If you like today's show, you can listen to it again or recommend it to your friends by going to kboo.fm/oldmolevarietyhour, where you can find some more information about our guests and topics, as well as listen to past shows. Today's show should be up in a day or two, and you can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Well, first up today, Bill Resnick talks with soil scientist Fred Magdoff about what's happening and why to an essential source of our lives, the soil in which our food is grown. Here's Bill.
Fred Magdoff, welcome to KBOO.
Good to be with you.
Fred Magdoff is an emeritus professor of plant and soil science at the University of Vermont. His research was pioneering on ecologically sound ways to improve soil fertility, especially focusing on the critical role of organic matter. He is co-author of a book, Building Soils for Better Crops, Sustainable Soil Management. That was the third edition, was 2010, and it's available on the web, actually, if you want to go to it and read it. Is it completely technical, Fred?
It's written for farmers and students, not written for scientists.
He also wrote another book written for a popular audience with John Bellamy Foster, What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism. That's 2011. You've been very productive recently. He's written a lot on the multiple problems of capitalist agriculture and also the solutions, what you call ecological agriculture, and the sweeping changes necessary. That's sometimes called ecological civilization. Fred, soils are receiving increasing attention, examining how current dominant farming practices, that is, capitalist agriculture, though the writers often avoid that term, about how current dominant farming methods are depleting soils and contributing to global warming. First, tell us about that, and then we can get to solutions.
Well, you're right, that soils are getting more attention, and that's wonderful. I once gave a talk some years ago, soils as the underappreciated natural resource people sort of didn't think about, because they, when they thought about natural resources, they thought about forests or water, you know, lakes and streams, etc. And 2015 was declared by, you know, the UN, the Food and Agriculture Organization, as the year of soils, as to put emphasis on it. So it is gaining more attention, but there have been many problems. One of the reasons is because of the many problems that agriculture has faced with regard to declining soil, basically declining soil health. Soils have become less healthy, they grow less healthy plants because of the wind, and then you need more pesticides to help the plants, you need more fertilizer to help the plants, you need to irrigate more frequently because the soils don't hold water as well as they used to, and you have sort of a declining spiral.
I read one of your recent pieces arising out of this concentration on soils. The carbon composition of soils and the plants is greatly changing because of all of those factors. And the carbon is not being replaced in soils. It's, in fact, now becoming more greenhouse gases. That is, there's more CO2 emitted. How did that happen?
Well, first off, you got to keep in mind that carbon in soils is organic matter. All of life is based on carbon. The major molecules in our body that carry on life are carbon-based. So the organic matter is old roots and dead microorganisms and other crop residues, etc., that are in the soil. And so the carbon in the soil is the same thing as organic matter. Building up organic matter is one of the ways to build healthy soils or to create healthy soils, because you're feeding the organisms that are in the soil. What you want is a lot of biodiversity in the soil. There's a lot of discussion about biodiversity, you know, in plants and animals above ground, but we want biodiversity in the soil so that you can grow healthy plants. If you don't have a lot of biodiversity, you get more diseases, more problems with nematodes, a little parasite that can be on plant roots feeding from them. So I think there's all sorts of reasons to build up organic matter. It is beneficial for the soil in almost every respect, chemically, physically, and biologically, so that higher organic matter soils are able to grow healthier plants.
And more nutritious foods, I assume.
Well, I expect so, but it certainly will be foods that will not need pesticides to be used on them, and so there'll be that. Whether the mineral content is higher or not, there's some arguments about that, and there's data in both directions on that. It certainly tastes better when they do taste tests. I don't know exactly what that means. But yeah, I think the food will be healthier, certainly, if for no other reason is that that there won't be pesticides on it. What's happened is that with plowing the soils regularly, that is, plowing every year to grow a crop like corn or soybeans, as they do in the Midwest, it stimulates the decomposition of organic matter, especially those with the rich prairie soils where you had deep roots of perennial grasses that helped to build up tremendously good quantities of organic matter. Those soils have lost at least 50% of the carbon that they once had as organic matter. And what that means is it's ended up in the atmosphere as CO2. And it's not just those soils, but that's just an example. In many places around the world, the system of agriculture that's practiced is one which is really exploiting the soil and not regenerating the soil.
In fact, destroying the soil, right? I read about the Palouse. It used to be a huge grain producer in Washington State. And
right.
A lot of it is now, because of the winds and because of the plowing and because of the rain patterns, it's now all rock. The soil is gone.
Well, they had a major problem there. I visited the Palouse some years back, maybe 15, 20 years, and I happened to be there in the wintertime. One of the problems with soils as the organic matter breaks down is the soil structure isn't as good. You don't form these groups of particles they call aggregates as well. And I went out to some wheat fields, and you could see them sealed at the surface. Basically, all the surface structure was gone. It looked like chocolate icing on a cake or something. You couldn't see any pores. There was no place for the water to go when it rained. And so it just ran off, and it took the soil with it. You know, once you have runoff from a soil, you probably have erosion. And that's what was going on there. So it's bad from two points of view. You're not getting the water stored in the soil, and you're losing your topsoil, which is the best you got because it's high in organic matter.
Is that happening in the prairies because it was so deep? There was so much soil built up over the generations, the eons, the thousands of years across the farm belt of the United States and Kansas, Nebraska. Is that happening there? They're losing soil fairly rapidly, too, particularly like in the Great Depression prior to it, winds that blew the soil to wherever it was blown to.
Well, it came east.
Yeah, it had to come east.
Well, and during the dust.
The people went to California. The soil went east.
You know. That's right, exactly. It even hit Washington very dramatically at one point. Washington, D.C., I'm talking about.
Uh-huh.
But I think it has slowed down. There was a tremendous amount of soil loss, and it's still going on. It was once said that for every bushel of corn that they send down the Mississippi, you know, because that's one of the ways they transport corn out of the United States down to the Gulf of Mexico, for every bushel of corn going down the Mississippi, there was three bushels of soil that were going down as eroded material. But what's happened is that many farmers in the Midwest, not all, have started to use a practice called no-till, where you don't plow the soil every year. You plant into the old field, basically. You kill the weeds with an herbicide, that's how they do it, and just plant right into it. And they have no-till planters. So that really has reduced erosion. Farmers who do that have reduced erosion substantially, and especially if they're using cover crops. Those are crops that are planted that keep the soil covered in the season when you normally don't have a main crop being present in the field, that helps to reduce erosion as well. So in summary, it was a much worse problem, but it still hasn't gone away. It's still a significant problem in the U.S.
And agriculture as a whole is an enormous component of greenhouse gas, I mean, very large component of the total greenhouse gas emissions. That is from cows and the machines they use and the transport, in addition to, of course, the loss of carbon from soils.
Yeah, and also the conversion of, like, what's happening in Brazil, the conversion of the Amazon forest to maybe to pasture first and then to soybean fields. Yeah, you will lose a lot of carbon, no question, a lot of CO2 into the atmosphere as the organic matter decomposes.
This is KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Fred Magdoff. He's a soil expert, has written a great deal on both soils and the depletion of soils from capitalist agriculture. In fact, all bad agriculture practices. Fred Magdoff, a lot can be done. Soils can be regenerated, and we can even grow healthy food without the pesticides and the fertilizers and the rest of the contaminants. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we know how to grow food without using pesticides. And the reality is that you can grow just as large crops without pesticides as is done with pesticides. And also, even without fertilizers, if you're using legumes to produce nitrogen, you know, because they have nitrogen-fixing bacteria that live in their roots and nodules in the roots and are careful in recycling and reintegrate animals with the land. What's happened here is that we've segregated the animals out to these animal factory farms where beef and hogs and poultry are raised in confinement, and the feed is brought to them and creates two problems: depletion of fertility in the fields that grow the feed, and then there's all this manure that accumulates by the factory farms that they have to get rid of. So if we reintegrate animals into the cropping system, that's another way to do things better. Using cover crops is another one that I mentioned earlier. Routine use of cover crops is really important, and better rotations. Many times farmers here don't rotate very well. Sometimes they don't even rotate at all. They'll grow the same crop year after year after year. In the Midwest, it's maybe corn and soybeans alternating, but that's not a real rotation. That's they refer to that as crop alternation. That it's not really a rotation of crops. You need to have more complexity in the system, more complexity in the soil, and that's done by organic matter, building up organic matter, and more complexity in your rotation so that you have above ground healthy ecosystem above ground, not just within the soil.
And we have models for doing that. There are lots of farms that are adopting those practices and organizations that are trying to teach them, and organizations like Worldwide Via Campesino that's working with small farmers to adopt those practices.
Yes, absolutely. I was in Brazil 2 years ago in June and visited a settlement of the MST, the Landless Workers Movement, one of their early settlements where they actually have settled people without land on the land. And they're doing a wonderful job growing using ecologically sound methods. They have good mulching on the surface to reduce weeds and to help with the water retention. They're using agroforestry, so they're planting trees, and underneath the trees, they're planting the crops. The trees are far apart. The rows of trees are far apart. And the trees, they can be different species. Some are just used for wood, or they may be legume species so that you can use the leaves and the branches as fertility sources. So, yeah, absolutely. It can be done on a small scale. It can be done on a larger scale. But we do know the practices that add up to ecologically sound agriculture.
You said it can be done on larger scale, but a lot of capitalist agriculture, that is the big industrial agriculture, are they adopting those practices?
They're adopting some. They're not adopting all. I mentioned about no-till, which is a beneficial practice from the point of view of erosion, but still depends on a lot of pesticides. So they're doing something that's good, but I wouldn't call that ecological agriculture or ecologically sound agriculture. Also, they have tremendous amounts of nitrates that leach out of their soils because of the simple rotation that they're using of just corn and soybeans and the tremendous amount of fertilizer that they use on the corn. So the quantities are just unbelievable. I calculated that some million pounds of nitrogen was going down a river called the Raccoon River past Des Moines, Iowa. This is a tributary to the Mississippi. And a million pounds of nitrogen as nitrates just going down the river. It's going to hit the Mississippi. It's going to go down the Mississippi and create that, help to maintain that dead zone, a so-called dead zone at the mouth of the Mississippi and the Gulf. There are a lot of different issues. So I think some farmers are starting to use individual practices that are good, but they're not putting all together the practices that are needed to get to what I would call an ecological agriculure.
This is KBOO Radio, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for The Old Mole talking to Fred Magdoff, who is a soil scientist who writes about farming and capitalist agriculture as well as capitalism as a system. Fred Magdoff, let's talk about capitalism as a system and dealing with global warming. The questions are not just technical. I mean, you pointed out that there are technical solutions for soil problems and food problems. But that's part of the, seems to me, of a capitalist agriculture and the sort of the consumer society. But there's much more to it, and you've written about it. Tell us about how, in fact, our economic practices and our consumption practices have to change. It's just not a matter of personal behavior. It's a matter of system change. Tell us about that.
Well, I think in capitalist economies or societies, there's two main reasons that the system is anti-ecological, where it actually works to degrade the environment. One reason is that it is an economic system that has to grow. It just, capitalist society has to grow. It has to produce more stuff next year and get you to buy it, of course, get people to buy it, than it produces this year. If it's not growing, it's in crisis. You know, it's been said that perpetual growth on a finite planet is impossible. It can't go on forever. But capitalism has no way of stopping growing and doesn't want to, because that's the way more profits are made, is by producing more stuff. And it has to convince you to buy it. So there's a huge sales effort. Maybe $1 trillion of our economy goes in one way or another to try to convince people to buy stuff. And this is all consciously, they understand they got to get rid of it. You know, if they're going to make money, they can't just produce it. They got to sell it. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect is that there is no way to take into account during the process that capitalists go through to make decisions about what to produce and where to produce it and how much to produce. There's no way to take into account the environment because they're looking at profits. That is how they are judged. That's how corporations are judged. That is the motivating force, the moving force. That's what they're after. They're not after producing something for you to use. They're after producing something that they can make money at if they convince you to buy it. So that, to me, those two aspects, that there is an imperative of the system to grow. It has to grow and strives to grow. And individual capitalists strive to grow as well. And countries strive to get their economies growing. And then there's the issue of profits being the determining factor in almost all decisions. And once you have that, that's in the absence of regulation. Now, there can be regulations which force you into saying, well, no, you can't do that here because there's a wetland. Okay, so there are, for example, nowadays in the U.S., there's some provisions about wetlands, but even those are relatively minor as far as their effects, their helpful effects, that is.
And that's so, all being reversed, actually, now.
Oh, yes. I mean, all that's the problem with regulation is it can be unregulated. And as we're learning, it's happening. It's happening right now.
Fred Magdoff, I don't want to end on that note. What is also happening now is that we are in a period where, as we're losing a lot of battles, we've won a number of big battles over the years. I mean, one of them, of course, is questions of equality for formerly subordinated groups. Of course, that's been furiously opposed, yet still people sort of see that as a goal. But another one, of course, is soils and health and how we live. And people are beginning to sort of recognize in lots of ways that the system as it exists now is not healthy for them and that we need something else. What else will be is a big question. It seems to me you've contributed to that in your research on soils and your books. Do you have a last word on those sorts of questions?
Well, I think this is a unique time. We have unique opportunities in the United States especially, but also in some other countries. The government seems to be going backwards. Not that the previous governments were all that good, but what's happening now is retrograde and will have serious consequences. On the other hand, I think you're absolutely right. People are willing to talk about capitalism. The word can be used. Some people are starting to see that there are systemic problems, that it's not just an issue of racism, but it's an issue of racism and ecology and the lack of equality in the society, and that these all come together. These are all related, and we've got to solve them together. We can't solve them individually. These are systemic issues. They're caused by the way the system functions, and we need a different system that functions a different way in order to solve these many different problems that people are concerned with. And I think the opportunity that exists now that didn't exist maybe 10 or 15 years ago is that many people are willing to talk about that and consider it. And then we can maybe have a discussion about what comes afterwards. That's what Chris Williams and I tried to do in a new book that we wrote called Creating an Ecological Society.
Fred Magdoff, thanks for talking to us today.
You're very welcome.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, oh, the farmer is the man that feeds them all. If you'll only look and see, I think you will agree that the farmer is the man that feeds them all. Oh, the farmer is the man, the farmer is the man, lives on credit till the fall. With the interest rate so high, it's a wonder he don't die. And the middleman's the one that gets it all. Oh, the banker says he's broke and the merchant's up in smoke, but the farmer is the man that feeds them all. It would put them to the test if the farmer took a rest, then they'd know that it's the farmer feeds them all.
And that, of course, is Pete Seeger singing "The Farmer is the Man," following up on Bill Resnick's interview with Fred Magdoff about how the soil is faring under capitalism. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Stay tuned for a critique of patriotism and to hear why the world's nations mostly ignore Israel's treatment of Palestinians. Right now, though, on the Old Mole, here's Jan Hocken with her guest, Laura Swerdlow, Interim Executive Director for Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon, to talk about Trump's latest attack on poor women and reproductive rights. Jan.
Well, Laura Swerdlow, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, your advocacy work in Oregon is on behalf of Planned Parenthood clinics and services, but also more broadly focuses on access to reproductive health services, and including how to strategize around the recent Trump administration's push for a new policy that would essentially be a national version of the federal government's global gag rule. And I think sometimes people don't realize that Planned Parenthood International is separate from the Planned Parenthood Federation of America. And just by way of background, the International Planned Parenthood Federation estimated that the $100 million in funding they lost because of the international gag rule likely could have prevented 20,000 maternal deaths in 29 countries. And so the gag rule, which is an interesting term in terms of something you really want to choke on and expel, this rule has prohibited clinics receiving family planning funds from even referring or discussing abortion as an option. So, Laurel, what's the situation here, and what does this mean, the domestic gag rule that apparently the Trump administration has put forth a new policy on?
You're right, Jan, that this rule is different from the so-called global gag rule. This particular gag rule, this domestic gag rule, would do primarily three things. It would impose new rules that are designed to make it impossible for patients to get birth control or preventive care from reproductive health care providers like Planned Parenthood. Second, under this rule, doctors, nurses, hospitals, and community health centers throughout the country could no longer refer their patients for safe, legal abortion. And third, it removes the guarantee that you're getting full and accurate information about your healthcare from your doctors. For nearly two decades, Title X law has been very clear. Healthcare providers cannot withhold information from you about your pregnancy options. This rule would mean that they could.
And I think it's important for people to realize, whatever their stance is on abortion or reproductive health services, that this is in direct conflict with the ethical guidelines of the College of Obstetrical and Gynecological Medicine, and that healthcare providers are ethically required to provide this information. So what basically administration is requiring providers to do is not ethical.
That's right. I mean, we can all agree that patients should have access to the best medical care and information possible. And this rule would do the opposite. We've seen what happens globally, as you mentioned, when Trump and Pence imposed a global gag rule on their first day in office. Services are being cut, health centers are forced to close, and women are going without care. It's estimated, as you referenced, that the countries that will lose key health care providers will see an increase in both maternal mortality and unsafe abortions. That's what we're facing globally, and it's absolutely unconscionable that they're now intending to implement this domestically.
Now, in Oregon, it's the least restrictive by some measures state. There are no laws restricting abortion, like mandatory reporting or gestational age limit. Although the Catholic health system in the state can refuse those services, but there's no state law that restricts them. Oregon also has passed the 3391, the Reproductive Health Equity Act, that expands services. How does this federal policy meet the rubber of the road meets Oregon law.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, Oregon, as you said, is the only state in the country that has no restrictions on access to abortion. But we all know that just because there are no restrictions, that doesn't mean that there is meaningful access. What this federal rule would do is it could prohibit federal funds from funding the necessary reproductive health services that women rely on here in Oregon. To be perfectly clear, if implemented, this domestic gag rule would, as I said, take away basic rights and health, period, by prohibiting those federal dollars from funding the services that women and families need in Oregon.
And so one effect is that states that have made a commitment to this care for women, which is so much a social class issue, because women of means can afford to access these services, but Title X funds like the Hyde Amendment really affect low-income women predominantly. And so in Oregon, there has been a commitment to providing access through state funds. So this puts an enormous burden on the state, is that correct, to bridge that gap if federal funds are withdrawn?
There's definitely an interplay between state and federal funds going on here. And I think that, we will definitely be, when funds are withdrawn, we are then faced with bridging that gap, as you said.
With fundraising or with state funds.
That's right. I mean, we both at, Planned Parenthood and reproductive health advocates throughout the state are dedicated to ensuring that all Oregonians, regardless of income, citizenship status, type of insurance, are able to access the health care they need. And so by withholding federal funds, we absolutely will be faced with the burden of determining how access to healthcare can be funded for those women that would be impacted.
Seems like there's also a need for a massive protest within the healthcare field saying, we're not going to be gagged. We are going to continue to do our job. It's ethically required of us, and we join as partners with the services like Planned Parenthood that takes the heavy hit here, that we stand in solidarity and we're not going to be gagged.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that, Jan. I think that, one thing that is clear to me, and I think to a lot of folks and I know for folks throughout the country, is that everyone has the right to access information about their healthcare, including information about safe legal abortion.
And that's not only a feminist principle.
Absolutely.
Or an abortion rights principle. It's encoded in the professional standards of all the specialties of medicine involved in this care.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think the point that you made about how this disproportionately impacts lower income women is really important to highlight here, because when we're talking about those ethical standards, everyone has a right to access that information, that information, no matter how much money she makes, no matter, the insurance that she has, no matter where she lives, everyone has a right to access information and medical care, no matter what. And this, they won't get that under this rule.
Now, can you just explain a bit about Title X, just for people who aren't familiar with Title X funds?
Yeah, absolutely. So Title X is a federal grant program that enables and ensures access to family planning and reproductive health care. This is a federal grant program, as I said, and there are grantees throughout the country that receive this funding. The state of Oregon is itself a grantee.
Mm-hmm. And the way the anti-abortion forces that are quite fixated on this aspect of reproductive health care, although there's been a revival of anti-birth control and anti-sex education in this this conservative wave overtaking the political class, but in the past, Title X funding has required places like Planned Parenthood to separate their contraceptive other services from their abortion, the services related to abortion procedures. And this not only underscores that separation, but basically kind of pushes it out the door.
That's right. It takes it to a different level. For example, under this rule, if a woman is pregnant and wants or needs an abortion, her provider will be prohibited from telling her where she can go to get one. Or if a woman's pregnancy would severely affect her health, for example, she discovers that she's pregnant after being diagnosed with cancer, her healthcare provider could refuse to tell her that abortion is even an option. So just stop and think about that for a second. What this would do is it would prohibit any provider from giving that information to their patients.
And of course, ethical providers will not comply with that. But then
the consequences
are what? For massive refusal to comply with something that's unethical and immoral. What happens is that then a clinic could be, a health center could be cited and investigated, and then funds would be...
Yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right that this goes in direct. It flies in the face of the ethical standards that several healthcare providers that healthcare providers generally are held to.
By their profession, by their license.
That's right. I mean, this rule is opposed by the medical community, by lawmakers, by public health experts, major medical associations like the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the American College of Physicians, and more. They all oppose this rule. When a similar rule was actually proposed in the 80s, it was met with the same tremendous outcry that we're seeing today. And so you're absolutely right that it really places providers in a position of having to choose between providing care in accordance with their ethics and their guidelines, and being able to be in compliance with, frankly, an unconscionable rule,
which is a kind of a moral dilemma of our times on many fronts. And I think it's perhaps one consequence is just throwing this work into a state of unnecessary chaos.
That's right. I mean, we're at a 30-year low for unintended pregnancy and a historic low for pregnancy among teenagers. I mean, with this rule, we are going to be walking back that progress if this rule is implemented.
Because it does make it more difficult.
It will hurt. It will hurt
access.
Women and families. That's right. I mean, Planned Parenthood health centers serve 41% of patients who get care through Title X. And as you said, I mean, this isn't just Planned Parenthood, other healthcare providers as well who have been, working to improve reproductive healthcare throughout the country. Title X serves a racially and ethnically diverse patient base. At least one third of patients are people of color. More than one third are Latinx. 13% have limited proficiency in English. So this rule furthermore would not only roll back that progress across the board, but it would disproportionately impact underserved communities.
The Trump administration routinely dispenses horrific policy pronouncements that create a sense of kind of perpetual crisis. And some of these are bluster and intended to satisfy his base supporters. But some of them are, there really is power to exercise there,
yeah.
And sometimes not. Just in closing, where do you see the fight back beyond the professions, which, and I think this has been in some ways not very strong overall, not just abortion providers, but the professions standing up to support women's reproductive health care. Where do you see the fight against these immoral policies?
Absolutely. I mean, Planned Parenthood stands in coalition with reproductive health care providers throughout the country. And, together we will not stop fighting for our patients. We will not stand by while our basic health and rights are stripped away. And so I think, what you can see from us is we are going to be fighting back We are fighting back against this rule to delay and prevent implementation because we know that the consequences are absolutely dire. And we will continue to be fighting back against these types of rules, and we will continue to be providing care no matter what.
Yeah. It's the era for advocacy on the streets.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Okay. Well, thanks so much. This is Jan Hawken talking today with Laurel Swerdlow, the interim executive director of Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon.
Thank you so much.
Keep
for
up the good
me.
Work.
Thank you. You don't own me. Don't try to change me in any way. You don't own me. Don't tie me down, 'cause I'd never stay.
And that's Leslie Gore, You Don't Own Me. And before that, we heard Laura Swerdlow talking with the Old Mole's Jan Hawken about the right-wing efforts to keep women in the dark about their options regarding reproduction. And you are hearing all this on the Old Mole Variety Hour on your community radio station and website, KBOO. I'm Clayton Morgridge. In a few minutes, I'll be sharing an article explaining why Israel is able to deny the basic human rights to almost 5 million Palestinians in the occupied territories, Gaza and the West Bank, with not much, if any, objection from the rest of the world. But right now, the Old Mole's Tom Becker is going to read from Sam Hasselby's article, These Should Be the End Times for American Patriotism. Here's Tom.
Good morning. Patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel. That statement is credited to Samuel Johnson, the 18th century English poet, essayist, moralist, and literary critic. Today I'm reading from an article that explains why, for present-day America, this is especially so. The article is entitled, These Should Be the End Times for American Patriotism, by Sam Hasselby of Eon Magazine. Patriotism is the organizing passion of modern political life in the United States, yet its vitality defies obvious explanation. The country has no national education system. There's neither compulsory military nor civil service. No government agency distributes the ubiquitous U.S. flags, nor enforces observance of the rituals to country performed at schools and sporting and political events throughout the country. Despite lacking the classic machinery for inculcating patriotism and spreading it among the people, American patriotism is a norm in the true sense. One of the conceits of American patriotism, that is a wholesome version of the pernicious nationalism that other countries have helped to protect it from critical questioning of almost any type. Justifications for the country's patriotism tend to be shallow. They are often based on appeals to treasured details of family or community life. Patriotism is Little League baseball on a warm summer day, the courtesy of the small-town merchant, a neighborhood rebuilding together after a destructive storm. All nationalism makes sentimental appeal to intimate but generic experience, and the effects can help to raise armies and start wars. They carry, in other words, formidable political force, but they're not any kind of serious moral or intellectual case for patriotism. American patriotism is in some ways very old. Some of its defining qualities have changed very little, including the distinctive cult of the founding fathers, which began while they were still living. The great weakness of this preoccupation with the founders is that it is a convoluted, limiting device to which to think about the world today, much like the country's overestimation of its constitution, yet it plays an outsized role in American political debate and thought. Most patriotism enlists territorial rivals in the required role of the enemy. France has Germany, India has China, Britain has France. But America's particular historical experience in the New World reshaped this need. American patriotism turned to the task of conjuring ideological enemies, drawing on an Anglo, especially Puritan, propensity for casting outsiders as fearsome maleficents. American patriotism has always depended on conjuring alleged conspiracies from migrants or outsiders bearing existential threats, foreign devils all. Throughout the 19th and into the 20th century, it was Catholicism. The Anglo-establishment held Catholics to be unreasoning and beholden to a priestly power, unfit for the obligations of citizenship. That's why people who take the oath to become citizens must renounce allegiance to any foreign potentate, that is, the Pope. Then the Cold War made it communism. Like Catholicism, a nebulous and formidable global power, it also moving invisibly in the hearts and minds of immigrants to undermine the country from within. Now rival camps differ as to whether the existential threat is Sharia or Russia. Exceptionalism has always been core to American patriotism, and American exceptionalism is no longer tenable. Exceptionalism is the idea that the country bears some special lesson for the rest of the world, some vital role in the world history. But if the U.S. represents something invaluable to the rest of the world, what is that? In the 18th century, an experiment in Republican government filled the bill of exceptionalist pretensions. In the long 19th century, the availability of land for settlers combined with political democracy compared favorably with Europe's aristocratic regimes. And after the Second World War, the shared prosperity of post-war economic boom helped to revitalize U.S. exceptionalism. Now, there's no good answer. This core component of American patriotism, the popular conviction in a world historical role for the U.S., is unlikely to continue. First, it is increasingly difficult not to notice that in many basic matters of government and society, including health care, public education, gender equity, social mobility and prosperity, economic fairness, child care, environment, and more, the U.S. has fallen behind most of the developed world. The U.S.'s world historical ambitions have simply not kept pace with world history. Secondly, wars are nation-making events, but they can also be unmaking ones. If your patriotism is linked to the pretensions of a world historical role, what do you do when the world chooses not to emulate you, or when it, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, etc., doesn't want your Americanization project? Mere military supremacy, especially when it proves ineffective in achieving its goals, is unlikely to be enough to sustain the exceptionalist heart of American patriotism. The sacred status of American patriotism in the U.S. indicates only an ideological strength, not moral or intellectual soundness. The right-wing nationalism resurgent in many places, including the U.S., has convinced many Americans that reasserting patriotism is necessary, or at least politically strategic. But questioning American patriotism is a greater opportunity and might also be more pragmatic course, since some of its historical foundations are unraveling. It's time to start treating American patriotism, the most deadly form of identity politics, as a question, not an answer. I've been reading from an article entitled "These Should Be the End Times for American Patriotism" by Sam Hasselby. Sam Hasselby is a senior editor at Eon Magazine and an historian. He's the author of The Origins of American Religious Nationalism.
While digesting Reader's Digest in the back of the dirty bookstore, a plastic flag with gum on the back fell out on the floor. Well, I picked it up and I ran outside, slapped it on the window shield. And if I could see old Betsy Ross, I'd tell her how good I feel. But your flag decal won't get you into heaven anymore. They're already overcrowded from your dirty little war. Now Jesus don't like killing, no matter what the reason's for. And your flag decal won't get you into heaven anymore.
And that's John Prine with "Your Flag Decal Won't Get You Into Heaven Anymore" from his first album back in the Vietnam era. And that followed Tom Becker's reading of "These Should Be the End Times for American Patriotism" by Sam Hasselby. And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO. I'm Clayton Morgridge. To close out the show this morning, I'm going to summarize and read from an interview with Jeff Halper, co-founder of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, that was conducted by Mark Dalder and appeared in These Times. Why does the U.S. and the rest of the international community give their uncritical support to Israel, even though what Israel's doing in the occupied territories violates these countries' own foreign policies? They're all against the occupation. They're all for a two-state solution. They're all for international law and human rights. So what's going on?
How does Israel get away with it? Jeff Halper, an American Israeli writer and activist, takes on this puzzle in a recent interview in These Times, based on his book, War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification. Halper cites Henry Kissinger's remark that countries don't have friends, they have interests. So Halper asks, what are the interests that Israel serves around the world? His answer leads not just to an explanation of what Israel provides to other nations in return for their acquiescence in the Israeli treatment of the Palestinians, but it leads to an insightful picture of the state of global capitalism today. Israel's critics in the United States often point to the pro-Israel lobby, which cows many politicians into accepting Israel's claims that the Palestinians are an existential threat to Israel. But that lobby, Halper points out, does not determine American foreign policy and has no impact, for example, on China. There are Christian Zionists like Sarah Palin who see Israel's existence as a biblical prelude to the Second Coming and the Rapture. But that view does not bear on European support for Israel. Guilt about the Holocaust may have some effect in Germany, but not in the U.S. No, there is something that Israel is doing, serving the interests of the international elites. Put simply, Israel specializes in weaponry and techniques that enable capitalist elites to stay in power in spite of rising tides of popular protest and revolt. The nations of the world no longer fight with each other. Instead, their ruling elites fight what Halper calls securocratic wars. Wars against the people, against refugees, against poor people, against Black Lives Matter, against the Occupy movement. War today is really policing, and policing is really a kind of class war. To stay in power, elites need the technology of policing, technology Israel invents and hones in the occupation of Palestinian territories. So Israel creates what Halper calls global Palestine, the Palestinization of weapons of security to meet the needs of the ruling elites of the world. Halper claims you can't understand the context or why there is conflict and who's fighting whom and what forms wars are taking unless you put it within the capitalist world system's context. It's a capitalist world system that we live in that's generating these conflicts. The system is under tremendous crisis because of climate change, population movements, the need for scarce resources, and so on. Today, Halper says, the capitalist elites, the corporations, the governments that serve them, the militaries that serve them, are under tremendous stress. Capitalism has always been an expanding system, spreading into new markets, new frontiers. But now, it's captured the entire world. There are no new markets. There are no new places. So the capitalist system has started feeding off itself. The absolute power that it has, with no constraining opposition, means that all resources are available to it. It can waste and steal as much as it wants to. That creates tremendous popular resistance against the income disparities, the poverty, even concepts like surplus humanity. The corporations have basically declared 2/3 of humanity is surplus. They'll never be educated, they'll never be productive, and the worst sin is they'll never be consumers. The question is, how do we extract the resources on which they're sitting, but exclude them from the system? And how do we protect capital flow? How do we protect our lavish lifestyles in the global north and keep control of the global south, especially since the global south is penetrating into the global north? You have waves of migration like Syrian refugees. You have the rise of Black Lives Matter, representing the increasing disenfranchisement of poor people. Even among the middle classes that are being excluded, there are people who are saying, look, this system isn't working, and it's not sustainable, like the Occupy movement. Israel-Palestine is the microcosm of the larger world. What Israel's doing to the Palestinians not only reflects what the global north is doing to the global south, but also reflects the kind of war that capitalism is having to fight now. That's what makes Israel so relevant to the global north. The wars that are being fought in Syria, or the wars being fought against poor people in the United States, are not wars that F-35s or nuclear submarines are any use for. They've got these huge arsenals, but when they're actually going to fight wars among the people, Israel becomes the go-to place. They have the weaponry, the tactics, the surveillance systems, and the security systems that are more relevant for the types of capitalist wars of repression that are being fought today than the big systems that the Pentagon has. That's what I mean by globalizing Palestine. Halper points out that this kind of securitizing politics bypasses ideologies. For example, Israel and Saudi Arabia are super close. You could never explain that by normal international relations. But Israel can deliver against Iran and the other Shiite foes to Saudi Arabia and against forces of democracy in the Arab world. Israel supports conservative Arab regimes. The military and security bypass ideology. In that way, not only has it gotten away with the occupation for the past 50 years, but it's a strategic ally of the United States. It does exercises with NATO. It's a close military ally to China and India, and you'll find it in every global South country in the world. It's been very effective at working with all the power blocks that exist in the world for its own interests. As for the best response for the left, Halper argues that the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, is worrying Israel. He suggests that the boycott target American communities involved in importing Israeli police tactics, like Ferguson. In almost every part of the United States, the defense industry is very strong, developing everything from crowd control to weapon systems to surveillance systems with Israel. Israel works with Raytheon, Boeing, and many others. Those should be the targets, American targets, that bring it home. Overall, we've got to find ways to somehow combat this very militarized form of management that the entire capitalist system is imposing on us. I've been talking about and reading from an interview with Jeff Halper, published in These Times. I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
A blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains, just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down.
And that's Michael Hart with We Will Not Go Down, a song for Gaza, Palestine. Following my report on Jeff Halper's interview about the services that Israel provides to the ruling capitalist elites. And that's going to conclude today's Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO. Many thanks to Bill Resnick and Fred Magdoff for their discussion of capitalist agriculture, to Jan Hocken and Laura Swerdlow for alerting us about the new gag law, to Tom Becker for his reading about getting over patriotism, and to our engineer, Patsy Kullberg. I'm Clayton Morgridge. If you like what you heard this morning, check out our page on KBOO's website. That's kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you can listen to today's show or any part of it and let your friends know that they should be listening. You can also follow the Old Mole on Facebook and Twitter. Today's show should be up in a day or two. And join us again here next Monday for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's underground perspective. This program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Undergraduate Graduate School. No, sorry, that's Portland Underground Graduate School.
that creates racial lifelong learning opportunities that work for everyone's real lives. For more information, please visit www.pugspdx.com. And stay tuned to KBOO at 10 right away. Barbara Bernstein's weekly conversation will be here about our place on the planet. At 11, On the Ground Radio with special guests Jill Stein and Ajamu Baraka. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. To keep informed and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and the certification requirements of the Corporation of Public Broadcasting. Information about the KBOO Community Radio's open meetings policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, unless otherwise noted. The Finance Committee meeting will be held on May 24th at 4:30 p.m. at KBOO.
We're celebrating KBOO's 50th anniversary on June 3rd at 2 p.m. at the Oregon Historical Society's Outdoor Plaza. Join us for music, fun, special guests, and bring a homemade birthday cake to share and help us celebrate. Bike to the party as part of our Pedal Palooza bike ride. The ride begins at 1 p.m. at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8. Come ride your bike from our building to former locations of the radio station and end at the celebratory 50th anniversary of the very day we first switched on our transmitter and began broadcasting to and with the communities of Portland. Again, that's our 50th birthday party on Sunday, June 3rd at 2 p.m. at the Oregon Historical Society, 1200 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information on the party and our history can be found at 50yearsofkboo.fm.